So welcome, everyone. This is the October 18th, 2011 edition of the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace teleconference series. This is a regular series where we are interviewing and having conversations with leaders from the worlds of business, academia, and the faith and spiritual traditions, generally talking about a question of what can leaders in the business world learn from the faith and spiritual traditions that will help them to do a better job of serving all stakeholders. And we've had some amazing conversations over the past few months, and I'm looking forward to today's as being another in that series of just wonderful conversations from really leaders in this field. It's my pleasure today to have on the phone with us Alan Laurie. And I'll tell you a little bit about Alan and then have him chime in. But Alan is a rabbi, and he has a very unique background. He is currently a managing director at Grubb & Ellis, which is a national real estate service firm. He is based in New York City. And that follows a 25-year career as a licensed architect. As I mentioned, he's a non-denominational ordained rabbi. He teaches, he leads prayer services, and he writes on issues of faith and religion. He's a regular blogger on the Huffington Post. And this combination of meeting the demands of the business world while attending to the needs of the spirit gives Alan both insight into and access to a diverse community. And in addition to all those things, Alan is the recipient this year of the International Faith and Spirit at Work Leadership Award, which will be presented to him next month at the International Faith and Spirit at Work Conference. It will be at Fayetteville, Arkansas, at the University of Arkansas on November 7th through 9th. So, Alan, welcome to the teleconference.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on board.
Thanks for joining us, taking time
sure.
out of your day to do that.
It's New York, and it's lunchtime, by the way. You know, and so we know lunch is for wimps. So
right.
this is great. It's a great way to spend lunchtime.
Just work right through lunch.
That's right. That's a New York way.
Well, that's an interesting point. We'll be talking about that a little bit as we get into the call. I also want to acknowledge Vivian Hill from the Tyson Center is on the phone with us. Vivian, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Vivian will be assisting with our technical issues so that that I can just stay focused on the conversation with our guest today. So as usual, our format for the call is as follows. I'm going to start with a short reading from the book that Alan has written, and I didn't even mention the title. I apologize for that. Alan, in addition to all the things that I've mentioned, is the author of a wonderful book called 5 Minutes on Mondays, Finding Unexpected Purpose, Peace, and Fulfillment at Work. And we're going to be spending most of our time today talking about the book and the collection of ideas that he has in there and kind of where it came from and how he came to write this book in addition to all the other things that he does. So I'm going to start with a short reading from the book. We'll follow that by a few minutes of shared silence, where I would just invite you to take a moment to turn to source as you define source, whatever is appropriate for you, and we'll share in that wonderful space of just silence for a few minutes. And then we'll come back and I'll begin to ask Alan some questions, engage in some dialogue. We'll do that for about 30 minutes or so, and then we're going to open up the phone lines and allow you, the listeners out there, to ask questions and engage in some direct conversation with our guest. I'll give more information on that as we get closer to the time, but the way that'll work is if you have a question, you can hit *6 on your phone. That will alert Vivian that you do have a question, and she can unmute you and will call on you and give you a chance to ask your question. So with that, I'm going to begin, and this is from, again, Alan's book, 5 Minutes on Mondays. In Hebrew, the word for work is avodah, which also surprisingly means prayer. This teaches us that there is a direct connection between the physical world of work and the non-physical world of the spirit. Both are seen as instruments of personal and social change, which, when operated in harmony, reinforce each other. Just as we pray for the blessings of spiritual sustenance, we work for the blessings of physical sustenance. The connection of these words creates an understanding that work must be approached with the same reverence that we give to prayer. And conversely, that prayer requires work, commitment, dedication, and regular practice. In this model, success at work is a blessing that eases our lives and supports and enriches those around us. This model states that just as the world, if treated with respect, is filled with endless abundance, when work is approached with reverence, there is more than enough for all. Spiritual business is based on the premise that, contrary to the common paradigm, one person's gain need not be another's loss. That success and abundance for one does not create scarcity for others. So we'll just take those ideas into a couple of moments of shared silence. Thank you. Well, Alan, that paragraph, it just has so much in it right there. I think we could spend at least the hour just talking about those ideas of shared abundance and one person's gain from a spiritual perspective. One person's gain in work does not necessarily result in scarcity for another. I mean, that's just an amazing approach, an amazing mindset, I think, to bring to one's work. But before we dive into that, though, the introduction to your book gives a great story of kind of how you came to write the book and a little bit about your own background. But in a few words, I want to kind of bring the listeners, those who have not read the book and are not familiar with your work, I'd like to kind of bring them up to speed and sort of answer, how does a man come to be a rabbi, architect, real estate executive, author? That's a lot of seemingly different hats being worn simultaneously, and I think folks on the line would be curious to know how that came about.
Well, it's not your usual story, and I have to tell you, it's not however I ever could have imagined my life. At any point. And I talk about this in the book, about how uncertainty and embracing uncertainty opens new doors that you never could have imagined and that are greater than you could have possibly imagined through your little egoic, you know, fearful machinations. But I grew up in upstate New York, and actually as a kid, I was a huge art lover. Art spoke to me before I could even talk. And so I had this sense through looking at art as a child that there was another world that was deeper and that spoke to us in ways that that often are not recognized in our kind of our common view of how things are. But I wasn't religious. I mean, I grew up in a Jewish family, and we did all the things and bar mitzvah and everything. But honestly, didn't find much in religion to my liking, and went to school and studied architecture, and got a job in architecture, and had two children and raised them, and did the best I could like we all do. And there was one day about 17 years ago or now. And where I had, frankly, an epiphanal awakening. There was an act of grace that occurred in my life, a spontaneous self-revelation of God, if you will, that just floored me and that redirected me very dramatically. And it would take a while to kind of go through that experience, but But after that, I was directly kind of asked by the heavens, if you will you do this work? And I said yes. And I've taken that, you know, as a center yes of my life. And after that, began to explore a lot of different spiritual traditions and began to do a lot of things and meditate and began to teach. And I found that very deep mystical Jewish teachings really were very much in line with my experience, and started studying that with a lot of depth and commitment. And after my children went to college, I had been divorced at the time, actually, and I met a woman in New York who's a cantor, a Jewish liturgical singer. She's actually she's a songwriter and quite well known within the liturgical world. I was living in Atlanta. She was living in New York, and we dated long distance until my kids went to college. And I moved here and determined to get my rabbinical ordination while also working. And I got a job here. I found a wonderful teacher who passed away last year at the age of 99, who was a real holder of the ancient Hasidic mystical Jewish teachings. And he worked with me for several years and finally ordained me. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with that. I just felt called to that ordination. And I was working here in New York, and to kind of get to the story in the book, I'm sitting on the train one day. I live up in Westchester, and I'm actually reading the Bible in Hebrew. I think I was going to either read from Torah or do a sermon that weekend. And I have my kippah, you know, my yarmulke on my head, so I'm going home, and I'm also drinking a beer, you know, kind of getting ready for the Sabbath and relaxing. And this man sits down next to me, who I recognized right away as David Arena, who's a very, very well-known real estate businessman here in New York, you know, on the cover of the newspapers and such. And, you know, and of course I want to do business with this guy, but I'm there studying the Torah, right? And the third of the Ten Commandments, which says don't take God's name in vain, means don't ever use religion for your own personal gain, right? Is really what it means. And put spirit ahead of anything. And so I said, well, I'm going to just keep on reading my Torah and pretend this very famous person's not next to me. And he leans over and he says, what are you reading there? And I told him what it was. And he looks at me and leans in very close and points around the train, and he whispers, he says, this is all an illusion, don't you think? And I said, yeah, yes, it is. And I met my first mystical businessman. And this is a man who is phenomenally successful, but also phenomenally deep in his commitment to honoring spirit. And he really became my mentor in this, and he became my teacher. And we became very good friends. To continue the story in the train, though, so we're having this incredible conversation, and I get up to leave, and I reach over to shake his hand, and I accidentally spill my beer all over his lap. And he looks up, and he says, well, now I've been ordained by a rabbi. He's actually Catholic. And he and I became very dear friends, and one day, to my surprise, he said, oh, I'd like you to come over and work for me. He was president of Grubb & Dellis at the time. And he said, I'd like you to come over and head up our project management group. And he said, but I'd like to ask you to do something for me. He said, our senior staff meets every Monday morning, and I'd like you to begin the staff meeting with a little sermon to the group. Now, he had never heard me speak in public. I mean, it's a very dangerous kind of thing to do, right? I mean, to certainly open that kind of conversation. He said, I trust you on this. And I started doing these Monday morning sermons, and never overtly religious. I mean, you have to be careful about appearing to be proselytizing or challenging people on their core religious beliefs. But I started talking about things like gratitude and persistence and honesty and trust and humor, you know, all those things that make our lives better. And people seem to like them. And after I would deliver them, and I always speak impromptu, I would write them down and send them out to our friends and our colleagues and our clients. And they started to get distributed very widely. And some local newspapers picked it up and started writing about it. And then the Financial Times approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in consolidating them into a book, which came out in April of 2009, called 5 Minutes on Mondays.
Wow. And here we are.
And here we are today.
So it was actually from the very beginning of your time there at Grubb & Ellis, this was a part of your offering.
It was, and I have to say it's I think I've gotten more out of it than other people have. Certainly to give these kind of messages to people and to talk about it. We all see the Occupy Wall Street, which is happening here. We all know what happened in 2007 and the fall of Lehman and what have you. And we all know that greed is at the root of that. And we all kind of point to New York City as the capital of greed, and rightly so in many ways. So to hear these kind of messages is certainly something people hadn't heard before. But to give them in with humility and with openness has really been a very powerful teacher for me. One, it's kind of forced me to live what I talk about. You know, there's a lot of teachers. The Talmud says those who learn to teach will teach. Those who learn to do will do and teach. And so we should always learn with the idea of doing. And frankly, I had lost track of that a little bit, and I had gotten so involved in the teaching that there really was a disconnect, I have to be honest here, between what I was saying and who I was. And this has been just a wonderful gift to really force me to look at how I'm being and to really be the things that I write about. Mm-hmm. And that's my current practice.
As I was reflecting on this call coming up today and reading your book and putting together some notes and thoughts about things that I wanted to talk to you about, one of the things that really struck me, and I'm calling you from kind of the heartland of the country. You know, Kansas City is where I'm based, and in Fayetteville mm-hmm. is just south of us in Arkansas. I mean, this is like the rest of the country. But right now, the eyes of the world to a large extent are on, you know, New York City is, now I know if you're a New Yorker, New York City is always the center of the universe. But,
you mean it's not? What?
But right now there is so much attention. From the standpoint you brought it up, and so I just want to dive into this a little bit. Obviously the financial meltdown, whatever term you want to use with it, the source of it being, we could say it's the source of a lot of things, but you use the word greed at the root of it, and we could mm-hmm. just call it that for the moment. But then now mm-hmm. what's going on with Occupy Wall Street and the rising up of people that are trying to have a voice in this issue and calling for some reforms and whatnot. And I was thinking about then talking to a man who is a leader in a major real estate firm. Now, you know, commercial real estate wasn't where this particular issue happened so much as a residential mortgage market. But there mm-hmm. you are, right there in the center of all of this going on, and yet you're this voice for a different path, it seems to me. And there's some irony in that, but I from my perspective, as a person that is generally hopeful, generally optimistic about the future, I guess here's the question in this that I'm mm-hmm. that I'm dancing around, and it's this: do you think that what has happened from an economic standpoint to the business world in this country and around the world, do you think it has made it at least temporarily more difficult to have conversations about these ideas that you write about, or has it? From a standpoint of more difficult because people, leaders in business organizations, might be more prone to kind of stick to the kind of the blocking and tackling, you know, stick to the things that they know, stick to the, you know, well, the solution out of this mess is to make more sales calls kind of an approach mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. solving problems. Or has it created an environment where people are more willing to look at the greater meaning and purpose of their lives and their work?
Yes.
Yes, man.
Yes, yes to both. Well, you know, look. First of all, I work with most of these large financial service institutions, and And I have to say, the people who I work with, and I don't work with the people at the C-suite. I mean, I'm not big, that big of a shot by any means. I mean, so I don't know those guys, up on the top floor. But I work with a lot of managing directors and people who are decision makers. And I have to tell you, with very, very few exceptions, they're lovely, wonderful people who are committed to deep values. And who are just like you and me, and we have to be careful about labeling a whole group because they're filled with human beings. And
sure,
clearly, there were some people at the very top who made decisions, and also for a variety of reasons. Some of them felt that they needed to maintain an organization, and they needed to keep the cash flowing and to keep people employed. There were certainly some who were simply working for their big, $100 million check at the end of the year, and that was their motivation. And so that needs to be untangled. But here in New York, you can, and it's eased since the fall of Lehman, but for years after that, you could feel in the streets, if you're sensitive to energetic to energies in this way, you could feel the fear. It was palpable, and the anxiety that people had. And when people are fearful and anxious, you can essentially go in two different directions, Tom, and this is what you refer to. I mean, if you look at human beings essentially as being spirit inside of a body, which is protected by the ego, and the ego being simply the software that's implanted in us so that we can survive, and that combines with your intellect in order to devise strategies so you won't be hurt, and you think of the spirit as the eternal animating consciousness that allows this bit of me to be conscious, and that connects it back to its source, which is a word I love that you used. And that's who we are, I mean, in the most kind of gross form. And when you're stressed, you can go one way or the other, And all the problems, I would say all, with capital A-L-L, problems that afflict humanity come from choosing ego and come from the fearful position that I'm in danger. Other people are threats to my existence. I better get mine before they take it from me. And that, often comes from some maybe damage and some abuse we suffered as children in which we went into this fearful survival mode. Or when you're pushed against the wall, you can, what every spiritual tradition says is you can simply let go at that point. And you can say, you know what, this isn't working. All the fear and all the machinations and all the anger and anxiety I have is not helping. And at this moment, I'm going to let that go, and I'm going to turn to spirit, which is a smaller, softer voice, right, as Elijah tells us. And I'm going to let that guide my life. And those are two directions we can choose. The ego is always going to choose greed, which, greed says that there isn't enough to go around, that resources are scarce, that other people want what you want, and that you better get it first, and it's always looking for security. Greed always wants security, and there's never ever enough. $100 million a year isn't enough because there's a guy making $1 billion, and he's a better than you, and you better run to catch him because only one alpha dog is going to survive. That's the story that the ego tells us, and that's greed. Spirit comes from the place of abundance. That says the world is filled with endless resources that, as you said, were treated respectfully, are here to sustain all of us, and ego is driven by gratitude. When you're in spirit, and you look out the window and you see this, we talked about the weather, whether it's raining, snowing, gorgeous or not, you go, this is the environment that I live in that was created for me, and this body which I have is not mine. I was given this, and life is a wonderful gift. And when you start from the position of gratitude as opposed to greed, you can be very successful, you can be very prosperous, but there's not an accumulation to be safe. It's an accumulation in order to contribute to the world. And so that's my long way of saying I see people choosing sides, And under stress, we're going to choose sides. Suddenly the mask of maybe false spirituality that we walk around with this little smile on our face, and a lot of spirituality is not particularly deep, and the ego can hijack spirituality to make you feel special or superior to other people. suddenly that begins to crumble, and you can really see what's underneath it. Or it can just totally fall off altogether, and you can be revealed in a deeper way. So I see people who are turning to spirit right now who say, you know what, this whole thing is showing me the fragility of all the stuff that I thought I wanted and the illusory nature of it, and they are turning to spirit. And you have other people who just dig in even deeper and become more greedy and more isolated and more competitive. And the message that I keep trying to get out to people is, you know, you can make a better choice than that. And that better choice is actually going to be better for you. You're going to prosper more if you can let go of that fearful attitude. And if you can live in faith, you're going to actually prosper more. You're going to be happier. The people around you are going to like you more. It's a better choice to make. Mm-hmm. And that's what all religions encourage us to do, is to make that choice. Moses, you know, before the people crossed over to the promised land, said, I set before you today life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life.
There's a chapter in your book that has to do with the search for truth, you know, kind of the ultimate capital T truth,
mm-hmm.
That you describe as this ongoing process. And I was thinking about that, and this is kind of taking off a little bit from what we were just talking about, but I was thinking about that idea, truth versus kind of collective beliefs, and that mm-hmm. oftentimes we organize and we operate our lives and our business organizations are just an outpicturing of that, just a way of kind of bringing people together to do something. But we kind of get into this place of collective belief. You know, we can have collective beliefs about, well, these systems have worked, this way of doing business has gotten us to this level of wealth, so we'll keep doing more of it and we'll get even more wealth and that'll mm-hmm. be all okay. But a leader of an organization has a responsibility to keep their eye on that stuff.
Right.
But there is also, from your perspective and your work, and I would say also the work of the Tyson Center and others that are involved in this, there is this calling to also keep our eye on this idea of what is the ultimate truth behind all this,
mm-hmm.
As we're going about these things. That seems to be a pretty challenging balancing act sometimes for somebody as a leader of a business firm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I believe that there is truth with a capital T. I think within human limitations, we can't know it, certainly not know it fully, and we can't claim to know it fully. And any claim to know truth with a capital T fully is an egoic claim as far as I can tell. But there is such a thing, clearly. You know, my good friend John King, along with David Logan, wrote this wonderful book called Tribal Leadership, which I recommend to anybody. And they went into organizations, and they realized that organizations and communities, from humans to nations, have mottos. You know, that they're run by a motto that they condensed pretty simply. And they said the lowest level motto is life sucks. You know, and he says, you can find this in some organizations. And we've all walked into organizations in which there's just this life sucks motto, whether it's a restaurant where service is terrible or whatever. A prison certainly has a life sucks. There's a neighborhood, some really bad ghettos, and even some affluent neighborhoods that are kind of driven by this idea that life sucks. And to the people who live by that motto, that seems to be true, right? That is their truth. And that's also their level of faith. You know, faith is not believing in somebody's dogma, and it's not, in spite of what maybe some people who are against faith, it's not the militant denial of reality in the face of fantasy. It's your interpretation. It's your interpretation, your subjective interpretation of the world, because none of us know the world, right? We have our limited access to it, and we all make up stories about why stuff happens. None of us really knows. Somebody steps on our toe when we make up a story. Yeah, people are so rude. Why don't they watch where they're going? You know, that's, you made that up. You have no idea why they stepped on your toe. And the stories we make up reveal our level of truth. And so your faith actually rises as you start to see it from a higher and higher perspective. And so the lowest level is simply life sucks. And then they say you move up from that to say, well, no, life doesn't suck. My life sucks. Well, that's a huge leap, because you're
Right.
recognizing the potential that maybe life doesn't suck. And then you get to the next level in which you say, I'm great, right? And suddenly I'm great, but other people aren't. You move up and you go, no, we're great. Me and my country are great, but of course other countries and peoples aren't. And the highest level is life is great. Life is great. And those are your levels of faith. And so as business leaders, as parents, as husbands, as wives, as whatever we do, we walk around with this construct that informs everything that we see and all the ways we react to it. And spiritual teachings encourage us to move up that ladder to a higher vision. And the greatest leaders I know are the ones who wake up every morning saying, life is great. And if they can walk into their office that way, and my David Arena is one of these human beings, who then they radiate that to other people, that changes the entire atmosphere. You know, I tell business leaders, I say, hey, you have more spiritual power than any rabbi or priest does, because you can change the lives of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people by how you're being. And
yeah.
So that's, I think if that's a long way of saying that there are many truths and the goal is to reach for the higher truth. You know, the example I give in the book, and you could say, Jim, committed to the truth. And the example I give is that you're sitting on your sofa and your wife comes down the stairs and she's happy and she's smiling and she's twirling and she comes down the stairs. And you can make this a man and you could be the wife, but I'm seeing it from the perspective of the husband. And the wife comes down the stairs and she has this new dress on and she's happy and she says, well, honey, how do you like my new dress? And you think to yourself, well, gosh, I've got a commitment to the truth. And you look at her and you go, eh, I don't like it. You know, it's dowdy. It's floral. It makes you look fat. As a matter of fact, you're getting a little fat, honey. Right? And, well, see, that's true, you know, and you're going to spend the night sleeping on that sofa, right? And you go, well, what I do? I told the truth. Right? So rewind, and she comes down the stairs. And she's smiling and she's twirling and she says, how do I look? And you look at her and you suddenly, this is the woman, this is my soulmate. This is the woman who puts up with all my nonsense, which all wives do, you know, and the husbands don't, we're too dense to often get it. Who's a radiant being and who I love with all my heart, right? And you suddenly see her that way and you say, my darling, you've never looked more stunning. And that's true too. Right? And chances are you're going to arrive to work late the next morning as opposed to sleeping on the sofa. And so which is the higher truth that serves you and your community better? And that's the one that you choose.
That's a great example of what you talk in the book about. You mentioned, you know, enlightened self-interest. That would be an example of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
from
right,
the male
right.
perspective anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right. But you start off by enlightened self. You go, okay, I could upset my wife or I could make her happy, and
right.
which one's better for me? You start doing that, and suddenly her happiness is your happiness.
That's right.
And suddenly it's not about enlightened self-interest anymore. It's about enlightened action.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming close to the time where we're going to open up the phone lines and let others call in and ask some questions. Just a quick reminder, if you have a question that you'd like to ask Alan, if you'll hit *6 on your phone, that'll raise your hand on Vivian's computer screen, and we'll be able to unmute. And that little reminder there told us that. As we're getting ready to do that, I want to make a couple of real quick announcements, and they are as follows. We've mentioned that the International Faith and Spirit at Work Conference is coming up. That dates on that are November 7th through the 9th. That'll be in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and where Alan will be presented with his leadership award, and we're going to have several keynote speakers, and the recipients for the Faith and Spirit at Work awards to organizations will be announced, and those folks will be there to present their work, and there's lots of workshops. Alan, are you doing a workshop there?
I am. I'm doing one titled Work as a Spiritual Gymnasium.
Yeah, and before we're done, I want to be sure and circle back around and ask you about that a little bit.
Sure.
So anyway, it's going to be a wonderful event. I'm planning to be there and looking forward to meeting a lot of these folks that I've been having the chance to talk to on the phone over these past few months. And in, as kind of a teaser for that, on November 1st, which is the next date that we're going to have one of these calls, I'll be talking with Dr. Judy Neal, who many of you know, and John Renish about the upcoming conference. We'll be talking about the themes and some of the ideas that we're going to be hearing about and discussing and getting a little taste of the conference to come. So mark that date. There'll be some information going out shortly on that. November 1st will be our next conference call. Look forward to having you join us. So Vivian, anyone ready to ask a question right now, or do I get to ask Alan another one?
Why don't you ask Alan one more question?
Okay. You kind of leaned into this a little bit with something you were saying earlier, but it's something I observe, and it was coming out as one of the themes in your book as well. And it even shows up right from the beginning in your book when you talk about your own path and the synchronicities and how by just kind of letting go and allowing things to unfold, amazing things happen for you in your life and really brought you to this point to be able to do the kind of work you're doing. But we have much of the time this image in our culture of the successful business leader as being the man or the woman who makes things happen.
Mm-hmm.
In the spiritual traditions, we have concepts like meditation and letting go and being in the silence and having a beginner's mind in the Buddhist kind of languaging. But it's this idea of the creative power of the space where we don't know, where we let go of control, and we allow something else to come through and happen.
Right.
Sometimes it feels like there is a real clash taking that idea into the business environment where it's all about making things happen.
Mm-hmm.
How do we begin to have that conversation and bridge that? And I think, you know, the work you're doing is a step in that direction.
Yeah, you know, I think it's somewhat of an unfortunate framing that we all have, myself included, of those two worlds, the world of doing and being, right? If you want to kind of get down to theological, you know, yin and yang, if you will, or you know, and then even Judaism has this in terms of our mystical sfirot, that one is about being and one is about doing. And we have a sense that doing is an act of will, you know, and being is an act of surrender. And I think, you know, even if you read somebody like Eckhart Tolle, who talks about surrendering into the now, you know, what he would tell you and what I would experience, what I've experienced. Well, let's back up a little bit. In terms of doing, I mean, you can do from will alone. We all, I think of us as like you know, battery-operated toys. I mean, we have a certain amount of battery life built into us, but if we don't recharge it, eventually the battery runs out and we're drained. Now, we may be alive physically, but we're drained in spirit. And we have enough will to push things through on our own, and you can push it just from the perspective of ego, as I talked about before, and you can probably get some stuff done if you're willful enough and powerful enough or cruel enough, as some leaders used to be, or you know, a dictator or something, and then you're going to want to force people to do what you want, and I would argue that ultimately is not a very successful way of sustainable action. Or if you tie into the source of your power, right, and let that flow through you, first of all, you're going to find that you have much more power to actually achieve than you could the other way around, because one, it's running on your own little batteries; the other one, you're running on an infinite source of wisdom and power. Two, by surrendering to the moment without agenda and without stories and without will, you actually find embedded in that very moment instructions for action that are much clearer and more powerful and more effective than the ones that your little head came up with on its own. And I think we've all discovered this. You get into a very deep meditative trance, and you can suddenly discover a solution to a problem that you've been struggling with for months, and suddenly it's so easy you can't believe you didn't think of it before. Well, because you're getting your direction from a source much higher than yourself,
right,
and infinitely wiser and infinitely more powerful. So the dichotomy. I think there's a fear that, gee, if I let go of this will, you know, Nietzsche's will to power, and I surrender into the moment, that I'm going to lose my will to do. And I would argue the opposite is true. You're actually going to be energized, and you're going to see solutions and directions that your little will never came up with on its own. And that is much more sustainable, and that is a win-win for everybody. I mean, the first way to do it is simply a win for me. The second way, if it comes through spirit, is always a cornerstone of knowing that you've received a spiritual direction is, does everybody win by me doing this? And if the answer is no, only I get something out of it, you can be sure it didn't come from spirit.
Right. Right. That's the voice of the ego.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
So I'm discovering, you know, the more that I look, I have a little mantra that I say to myself at work. And I want everybody to know that I'm in the trenches along with everybody. I struggle with this stuff like you can't believe, and I'm pulled in the same direction. So it's not like I'm fluttering above this at all. You know, I can talk about it because I'm down there, you know, mucking around with this stuff too. But I have, and there's three little mottos I tell myself when I find myself going off track, and they sound very simple, but they're really not. The first one is simply do good work, and doing good work is that's not about you. That's not about impressing people. It's not about getting ahead. It's about just honoring the fact that you're called to do quality work, and honoring the quality of what comes out of your hands and your mind. And so I say do good work. Number two, I tell myself be of service. What can I do within this situation right now to be of service? And three is stay present. And I find I repeat those selves, if I'm losing my presence or I'm not being of service or I'm doing shoddy work, by any one of those three, I always get called right back and puts me right back on track. So those are my little mantras that I tell myself at work.
Those are great. Those are great.
Yeah.
I'm taking a second to write these things down. Vivian, any callers?
No, I don't have any right now, but I have a question.
Okay. And this
sure.
is Judy. I'm after Vivian.
Okay.
What I was wondering is, when you mentioned, Alan, that you had a revelation of sorts or a meaningful moment that basically changed everything for you in this regard, can you tell me, like, I don't want to get too mundane, but what was the next day like? What practical things in your life changed in your day-to-day work life? I mean, like, did your schedule change? Did you get up earlier? What did you do? How did that affect your day-to-day business life?
I just saw the world differently. I literally saw the world differently. And what I did differently, I mean, I honored my time more, and I certainly saw other people in a very different way, because the experience I had was about the perception of other people. And you know, there was a moment which they all flooded into my heart, and the separation was gone, and I experienced them as me, and me as them, and I experienced the presence of spirit in a very powerful way. But yeah, you know, one thing that, I think this goes back to who is the founder of EST? Eckhart. Anyways. Werner Erhard, rather.
Right.
So, but he, I mean, you can say what you want to about EST, but he made a very good observation. He said that we get things upside down here, and especially in the West. We think that we start by doing. And then by doing certain things, we'll have certain things. And then once we have them, we'll be a certain way, right? So if I work really hard, I'll have a lot of money, and then I can be happy, right? And he says that the opposite is true. You begin with being. Being is the start. If I'm going to be happy, suddenly I'm going to start doing things differently, and then I'll have things. And he says, so you always begin with changing how you're being. And I would say, Vivian, that it changed how I was being, and that led to me doing things differently, kind of naturally.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I walked to work this morning, and I didn't mug a single passerby. although I had plenty of opportunities, and I could have stolen their wallet. But that's not who I am. That's not my being. But there are people who, if they could mug somebody without getting caught, would do it in a heartbeat, right? Because they're being in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This is Judy, and my question is about community. Because, Alan, you know, you've been talking kind of on the individual level about how we can integrate our spirituality and our work. But one of the things that you're being honored for is the outreach that you've done and the way that you're building community and connecting. And I think the people who are attracted to this field get to a point in their lives where that's important to them, to go beyond their own spiritual journey and connect with others who also see themselves on a journey and maybe help be of service to them in some way.
Yep.
You certainly do that. Could you talk about that more and how someone else who may be at that stage of wanting to reach out to others, how you think about it and what's worked for you?
Well, I'll tell you, I've learned this the hard way, Judy, and so I'm going to be really, really candid just for the benefit of others. So when I started doing this, and I mentioned earlier how much I learned from what I did here, and suddenly I'm this spiritual guy who's getting up in front of people, giving lectures, and I'm being interviewed, and I'm on Fox TV and New York Times and all this kind of stuff. And I have to say that I didn't do that well. I really didn't. And I started to think about myself as this wise spiritual teacher who could say inspiring things that would, you know, people would, jaws would drop, you know. And you know where that comes from. So I have to say I succumbed to that. And with disastrous results in terms of, not too disastrous, thank God, but just not good results at all, and quite the opposite. And that's kind of an obnoxious place to be, right? I'm the rabbi, and I'm going to tell you my wisdom so that you'll be a better person. Maybe someday, if you work hard enough, you'll be as good as me, kind of thing. that's not the way that you change people. And I talked about my boss, David. You change people and you build a community when you are those things. You don't have to say a word. You know, there's famous spiritual teachers who don't actually even speak. They sit there and they look at you. My teacher, who died, I mentioned last year, was one of those people.
Yeah.
He was 99. You'd walk to him, he would just look at you. And you would start to cry. You'd feel seen, mm-hmm. and that was tremendously transformative for you. So I'm a big believer in being in a certain way. I mean, I try to, and I don't do it as often as I'd like to, but you know, before I lead a prayer service or do a wedding or such, you know, when I'm ever doing anything that's considered holy, I always put my prayer shawl over my head and I say a short little prayer. And I say, may I be your. I'm talking to the big guy, in the, you know, up there, but he's not up there, of course. But I'm talking to the boss, and I say, may I be a channel and a vessel for your wisdom and service of others. It's that simple, and then I tend to be. And you know, imagine walking into a boardroom or into your office, and before you walk in the door, you say. You say to spirit, whatever, however you envision that, you say, may I be a channel for your wisdom for the benefit of other people? You're going to be so charismatic, and people are going to be so moved by how you're being, whether they know it or not, that they're going to come to you and ask for some guidance, as opposed to you coming to them and telling them. So I'm a big believer, Judy, and this is just where I'm coming from, I'm a big believer in individual that organizations are changed when you change the people in it. And so I'm a big believer in kind of trying to touch a person one at a time, usually in ways you know you haven't even done it. I mean, I've said or done things that I had no clue motivated and moved somebody, and I found out sometimes years later, they said, Alan, you know, that one thing you did or said really changed how I looked at it. And in that moment, you know, you drop on your knees and you're so grateful that you could have been of service to a person in a profound way, that that just motivates you to keep on doing it without any attachment to the results.
Right.
We have a question for Alan. Brenda, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Alan, thank you so much for your time, and thank you to the Tyson Center for hosting this. I want to almost parlay off of what you've just said about people coming to you and about the 5 minutes you would do on Monday mornings. Did you find that this almost, this 5 minutes of what I call feeding the people, I recently went to my company, I said, you know, people need to be fed, especially when times are tough. Spiritually, that this feeding the people, if you will, gave them a permission to now bring that part of themselves, as Lynn Sedgemore spoke about recently, to work with them. They now have this permission. And did you become, in feeding them, the buffet to which they would continue to return to have these sidebar conversations? And did this derail you from your daily work, or did you find yourself being the company sage or counselor, if you will?
Yeah. Well, for some people, you know, some people would knock on my door and say, you know, can I talk to you for a second, kind of thing, which is always lovely, and I really like that. I don't know the results. I have to be honest with you. I don't know the results. Some people have come over to me and, you know, said, you know, that was wonderful and thank you, and that was good for me. And other people, frankly, would grind their teeth and go, why am I wasting my time listening to this stuff? There's work to be done, right? And that's good too. You know, that's fine, and that's good, and that's needed. That voice is very much needed, by the way. And that's a wonderful voice. So I don't know. It did take me away from my work a little bit in ways that I talked about before. And I really have learned to refocus on my work and see my work, the work itself, as a spiritual practice, and let that speak for itself. But you know, gee, I love it when people, more often than not, quite frankly, some Jewish guy will come to me and there's a holiday coming up and he wants to know some detail about how to do the holiday correct. You know, that's more the kind of, we call it halakha in Hebrew, that's more the kind of question I get than the other. But, you know, there are people who have gone through painful life events, divorces and deaths, who have kind of sought me out for some guidance, and that's a wonderful thing to be able to do.
I agree.
Thank
well,
you, Brenda.
Thanks for going up.
Thanks for the call. We're winding down. We've got about 5 minutes left. And I want to, there's two things I want to do. I don't know if we'll have time for both. I would love to give you an opportunity to tell us just maybe a sentence or two about the work as a spiritual gymnasium workshop. That's of interest to me. And I also want to give you the opportunity for any closing remarks, or if there's a passage from the book you'd like to send us off with, we could do that too. So I'm going to leave that to you.
Okay.
Decide how you'd like to spend these last few minutes we've got together.
Yeah. Well, I do this little thing called work as a spiritual gymnasium, and when I was younger, I was really into weightlifting, big time. I used to love it. And I was kind of seriously lifting weights, and the way that you grow when you lift weights at a gym is to lift more than you thought you could, right? So this thing which seems to be an impediment and what, you know, why is this so heavy, and why is it heavier than yesterday, and is actually exactly how you grow, right? And you, those of us that are kind of, you know, gym rats know you don't go once to the gym, work out, and I think you're done, right? It's something you have to keep on doing. And so it occurred to me, you know, work really is a spiritual gymnasium. We're confronted with weights every day. I mean, suddenly there's a situation in which I could either impress the boss or tell the truth. You know, what's it going to be? And suddenly there's a big bar, you know, on top of my chest. And okay, am I going to lift it and tell the truth, or am I going to not lift the weight and just not tell the truth in order to get ahead? Right? And work confronts you with those situations, I think, more than just about anything else that we do. I mean, certainly parenting and your marriage are comparable in different ways. But I think work really is a great gymnasium for strengthening the spirit. And that's what this is about. And how can you be aware of those situations, and how can you respond in a way in which your spiritual muscles are going to grow? So that's what the spiritual gymnasium is about.
Great.
Yeah.
Sounds like some really great work.
Yeah, it's not theoretical. It's based on real life experience. I mean, what I try to write about in my book and in my blogs, you know, usually stems from something that really happened, that really led to an exploration of a direction to take it in. So that's what I do for there. And have we got a minute left?
We do. We've got a couple minutes left.
Okay. Well, the book is fine, but can I maybe leave everybody with a blessing?
That would be fantastic. Sure.
That's what, and within Jewish tradition, just to kind of frame this, when rabbis bless people, rabbis are not acting as agents of God. Everybody has a direct connection to God, which everybody's encouraged to deepen and strengthen. Rabbis are simply, you know, teachers who give tools to other people where they're needed. And one of the tools that I love comes from the book of Numbers, and it's the priestly benediction, and it's actually a threefold. It's, if you read in Hebrew, it's an amazing, amazing thing, Tom, because the first sentence is three words, the second is five, the third is seven, and the first blessing is for physical sustenance. This is like Maslow's hierarchy, right? And the second one is for emotional sustenance, and the third one is for spiritual sustenance. And there is a recognition that if we don't have physical sustenance, we're not going to have, I mean, there's rare people that can be deeply spiritual while they're struggling emotionally and physically, but those are the rare saints. Most of us need a good foundation of physical blessing, and then we need good emotional blessing, and then we can really focus on our spirituality. And I think a lot of spirituality goes wrong when we try to ignore those essential needs. And Judaism has always been a very kind of earthy religion in recognizing that physical and emotional needs really precede spiritual needs, and you build on those. So I'd like to say it actually in Hebrew first, because the Hebrew has power, and then I'll do the English. And this goes out to everybody. So the first is Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. May God bless you and may God protect you. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'chuneka. May God's face shine upon you and may God be gracious to you. Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yisem lecha shalom. May God's face turn to you and grant you peace all the days of this life and your many lives yet to come.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We've been talking today to Alan Laurie, who's the author of 5 Minutes on Mondays, Finding Unexpected Purpose, Peace, and Fulfillment at Work. Alan is this year's recipient of the Faith and Spirit International Faith and Spirit at Work Leadership Award. We'll be hearing from Alan and seeing him at the conference coming up November 7th through 9th. Join us again on November 1st for a preview of that conference, and have a wonderful, blessed rest of your day, no matter where you are as you're listening to this. And Alan, thank you again for joining us. I look forward to meeting you face-to-face in Fayetteville and getting you to sign my copy of the book.
I'm looking forward to it as well. I really enjoyed our time together, Tom.
Thanks again for your time.
Alan.
Thank you
Thanks,
to Judy
Tom.
For all you do for at the center and for making this possible. And Vivian, thank you for your work today and helping this to happen as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, take care, everybody.